this platform, Robert Ni Adeklerk. He is lawyer and author. Joining us via Zoom, Bobby Banson. He's a lawyer, teaches the law, Justice Abdullahi. He is lawyer and lecturer at UPSA Law School and the plaintiff in this matter. Osman Al-Hassan, he's also a lawyer who has written copiously to criticize the judgment. Later, we'll have others joining us, including Mr. John Ewa, Chief Executive Officer, Ghana Association of Bankers, or the banks, Dr. Priscilla Chumisi Bafor, Senior Lecturer, Department of Economics, University of Ghana, and Mildred Aziz, businesswoman, to look at how you can survive this economy, very harsh economy, and what should the managers of the economy do, even as they meet now, to take some decisions. Now, let's go to the Supreme Court's matter. As you know, that there have been criticisms that the judgment is perverse and problematic. There have been growing, you know, criticisms, some of them below the bar, if you want. And there are articles that are being authored, including one by some, by even non-lawyers like Dr. Arthur Kennedy, expressing concern about the unanimous decision, because he feels that whilst Ghanaians are divided, split on the decision, the Supreme Court cannot be so unanimous, because they live among us, they live with us, they are part of us. So what is it that leads them to be unanimous when Ghanaians are divided? You've heard President Akufo-Addo, you've heard President Mahama, you've heard the Speaker of Parliament, you've heard Professor Kweku Azah and Professor H. Kwesi Prempeh, two friends who don't really disagree, today disagreeing. We are looking at the potential problems that the judgment may bring. How can it be implemented? In just 1 week after the judgment, the minority has used it to hold government business to ransom, blocked proceedings in the House five times. Loans that need to be worked at to benefit the country have been stopped because they used the judgment. A judgment they criticized. Anyway, so let me start with Abdullahi, Justice Abdullahi. Thank you very much for joining us, Justice Abdullahi.
Yeah, thank you so much for being part of this program.
Great.
I am indeed elated to be here, and I consider this as possibly my last program on this subject matter, because I have been really heavily exhausted by the media for the past 2 weeks. And so I consider this as the first, possibly the last program that I'll be doing going forward. And so
there are too many young people who are giving up being out there, outspoken, and contributing to the discourse for good governance and national development. I think it doesn't help this country if too many of us begin to toe that line. I'm guilty. I've stopped, you know, being on, speaking on issues. The media calls me and I just simply tell them I'm not speaking. That's not good.
Samson, in my case, you may understand, particularly because of the tagging and the subtle insults and the potential threats that it comes with. And if you notice, during the course, I think yesterday and Thursday, there were rumors that I had snubbed President Mahama and had even insulted him and disrespected him. And some of these made front pages of some of the newspapers, and some of that is completely untrue. And so it's quite difficult in such circumstances to continuously be on air, because you never know the next line of mischief that will come because of this.
Did you say or you did not that President Mahama cannot give you advice on law?
You've always known me. I'll never disrespect President Mahama. And so I'll never use any derogatory comment on him, and not under any circumstances. I mean, you've always known me. prior from, I mean, the years back, as far back I'm sure as 2003. I have never been disrespectful of anyone. And so I wouldn't even want to justify it by explaining it. It would probably just make matters worse. And so I if President Mahama is online or whoever is watching, I'd rather render an unqualified apology to him because he's a person that I respect so much that he's been a leader of this country.
What are you apologizing for? He's not a lawyer. You spoke the law. And if he's seeking to give you some advice on law and you say he's not qualified to give you advice on law, what sin have you committed?
That is not the apology I'm rendering. The apology I'm rendering is the mischief that has been put on the comment that I made, that I snubbed him, insulted him, disrespected him. That is what I'm apologizing for.
Okay.
As for the issue of whether or not he's a lawyer, I think it's a matter of fact. And that does not amount to an insult. And so I wouldn't apologize on that.
Yes, however that young people must communicate with respect to the elders.
Absolutely the point, without having to disrespect anyone.
So, Justice, now let me begin with you on this note that for now I'm going to blame you. You are responsible for what is happening in Parliament now. Maybe by now, the five attempts by the NPP to have this, it's a European, I'll look for it again and give the correct description of what it is that they have been seeking to pass to help, you know, the economy, and it has been shut down, and other issues too have been shut down five times using this judgment. You have caused this.
Admitted. I went into this with that single objective as a patriot to bring all of us together and be able to forge ahead as nationals with a single objective of developing this country and protecting the welfare of our people and indeed advancing trade. And indeed, this, possibly the next objective was to ensure that we get that kind of judgment that all of us would embrace without having to target as a political judgment, as we've always done in this country. Invariably, whatever judgment that would have been obtained if an MPP-sponsored candidate, a plaintiff or an NDC-sponsored plaintiff had gone to the court, most likely would have had that kind of judgment that however good it might be, people will still shoot it down on the basis that it is colored and tainted with politics. And for me, this was possibly one of the salient objectives for going to the Supreme Court, that because I'm not linked to any of these political parties, I do not hold any political party card, I am not a member of any of these political parties, I felt deeply that, particularly also being a lawyer, if I appear before the Supreme Court and obtain a judgment, however unfavorable that judgment might be to myself as a person or to whoever will be affected thereby, and indeed, having said that, I need to point out that indeed all of us are affected equally by this judgment. Mm. Whether you consider it as a lose or you consider it as a win,
okay,
you are affected equally thereby. Because really it's a judgment that, as you rightly pointed out, the NDC and MPP will all use it going forward. Because it becomes a guiding principle for all of us. And so all of us are equally affected. It's not really a loss or a win for Justice Santulai.
Mm. Do you feel personally hurt? And I'm asking from a lawyer's perspective. In this case, you went as a plaintiff. As a lawyer, I go to court, I put my best foot forward, do the best I can for my clients, and that's where it has to end. You don't go to court always seeking to win, because that's not how it ought to be. So do you feel personally hurt that you wanted the court to say that deputy speakers cannot preside and vote to take decisions, and the court disagrees with you?
Chanting, I'm not hurt. I however disagree with that position because I did feel and strongly still feel safe that if you check our constitutional history, that office, the speaker's office, and in that, when I say speaker, including his deputies, has been an office that has been tagged with neutrality and impartiality. And this is what I have been saying from day one, in fact, right from the moment that the judgment was given, that that portion of it I disagree, because I felt strongly that it is the best way that we have the best from Parliament. If you have a speaker tainted with politics or who is seen to be politically aligned, you are likely to have a decision that would invariably favor a political party rather than advance the national interest. And that way you do not get the best out of it, obviously.
Right.
So to that extent, indeed, I wasn't happy that the Supreme Court saw the line that they did, because I was hoping that the Supreme Court would not only look at the present circumstances, but also consider future occurrences.
Right. So
really, I will, supposed to be a great document.
Right. I'll return to you so that we can get a sneak peek into, because we've heard you in the media say that you are looking at the possibility of a review and that you've been trying to draft some things to see. Let's see where you have gotten to and whether it looks, you know, good. At least a few of the points that may convince the public that it's worth going back when a unanimous decision has been taken. As far as the public is concerned, because it's unanimous, there's no point wasting your time going back. But we as lawyers know that that is not what it ought to be. It can be unanimous today, and on review, some of them may change their mind because of some things that are brought up later. Bobby Banson, thank you very much for joining us. Do you still teach the law at the law school?
Yes, civil procedure.
Great. Now, what will you say first off about how the judgment is presently being used? And among others, it has been used to block government from, you know, getting approval for a 20 million euro German Development Bank renewable energy agreement. They cited lack of quorum. You hear the minority. Anytime they want to start the business, they get up. And now they have proclaimed that with exception of prayers, everything will go by votes.
Good morning, Samson, and thanks for having me. Before I address your question, I would want to use this opportunity to encourage my friend Justice. I mean, I agree and I associate myself with your admonition to him that in his practice as a lawyer, I'm sure he would have come across clients who are as difficult as the media, as he claims, and have bastardized him for things he has even not done. I mean, this is not the first case he's been that is in the public. Some have been in the public and he's been wrongly misrepresented. But for the sake of posterity, it's not all of us that can wear that crown. So if his neck is strong enough to wear that crown, some of us will be behind to continue to push him. And it goes further to for the call that there may be perhaps a time for a public fund to be set up to sponsor some of these things, so that people like Justice will not only be committing his time, because he's a professional, he's a lecturer as well, his financial resources, and at the end of the day, be bastardized by the media. But if there are civil societies that will commit time and fund and resources to some of these things, then it will depersonalize it, so that people will not see that, oh, it is Justice who has sat somewhere. So I think something you made this call some time ago, maybe we should push that agenda and get these civil societies that speak about some of these things to commit resources into a fund, so that persons that feel strongly about these constitutional matters, that have a far-reaching events on our democracy, mm-hmm. on our corporate governance events, and our society as a whole, will be sponsored not in their personal capacity,
right.
but of the group, so that mm-hmm. it will be personalized. Okay.
Now, just hold on briefly for me there, because this is a very interesting point. And I understand Osman just joined us. Osman, what do you think about this? Because these litigations that individual Ghanaians take are not for their private personal interest. They benefit all of us. A good example, Martin Tebu went to the court a number of times and said there ought not be a crime labeled as non-bailable. He's been successful. Because of that, every offense is subject to amenable to bail. Because of him, if you get arrested, you get a surety, and the surety, you know, the person runs away. The surety is not arrested and put in jail. What do you say about this idea about a fund for constitutional public litigation?
Well, it's a great idea, because there are so many things that need to be clarified in the constitution. And you see, it takes courage for someone to enforce a constitution, because it's a national document. And where you go is the highest court of the land. And so if there is a, if we need clarity, and you see, constitution, the way we implement constitution determines the national security as well. If you look back in history, you see, if we joke with a constitution, things can happen. And so if someone undertakes to enforce a constitution or to bring clarity to the path the constitution has charted for us, I think it should be commented, and I think any support for it is great.
Thank you very much. Let me get let me get Robert's view on this. What do you say about that? You hear people, particularly those who are very critical and those who are in politics and are engaged in propaganda. You say one thing, they say, go to court. If you go to court, it's money.
It is. It definitely is, but I think that we should go to court whenever we can. It's the nature of the game. It is a system that we have all agreed to play by, and so I believe that we should go to court. And I really want to commend Alhaji for going to court. In the end, what he wanted, he didn't get, but he still got us to get some clarity with respect to a certain position. I do not think that he should bow out at this time or be disturbed by people commenting or people labeling him or calling him whatever. That's the name of the game. I mean, look at all the history of Ghana. You can go back as far as wherever to look at our constitutional challenges, etc., and all of that. These are people who have taken bold steps to challenge things which they did not agree with, and it will not end now. On the specific point of getting a group to fund such projects, trust me, it sounds like a good idea, but it will be a difficult one to implement. I say so because, look, we're in a society where every group is labeled. Every group is labeled. Some group, the most recent example would be Occupy Ghana. If I were to ask people ordinarily, what do you think Occupy Ghana supports in this country? They would give you a political party, correct or wrong. So it depends on who comes together. And are we likely to get people of the two leading political parties in this country coming together to form that? For which reason we probably break down the belief of political bias.
It could be a fund in the justice system, the judiciary, so that once you file the process,
yes,
then you are refunded for your expense. What you would have normally charged from a client, at least you can get, say, about a quarter or half of it.
So are you addressing just the cost? Are you addressing just the cost, or are you addressing the political clouding and the coloration that comes with
it? Bobby's suggestion is about the cost.
Okay.
To fund the people. Because justice is contemplating a review.
Right.
And you can imagine the time he sat to spend.
Absolutely. That wouldn't be a bad thing to do.
Okay.
As a matter of fact. I mean, if you're talking just about the cost of it and you want to do it. But I don't see it happening.
Okay.
I don't see it happening again because if you say the state should fund actions against itself, we know that the state is the state and it's not necessarily the political party, in theory. In practice, we know who is the defender of the state, the party in power at any given point in time. I'm much of enough of a reality.
So it should be a public fund. That.
So public fund, something, is somebody has to initiate it.
All right.
The only time I see it happening is when the party is about to exit office. Then they are happy maybe in the last 2 months.
So Bobby, I get back to you on how this judgment has been used at least in 1 week. The minority says, except for prayers, everything will be put to a vote. And when it comes to a vote, they will need to determine quorum.
Yes, it wasn't not to be expected, or it's not surprising. They had made those suggestions as soon as the judgment was passed, that they were going to follow it to the letter. And to the extent that what they are asking for is in line with the Constitution, you cannot fault them. And I watched one of the videos where when it came to, I think, discussing an amendment to the criminal law or something like that, they didn't complain, they finished. And as soon as he came to the loan agreement, they said, hey, hold on, we do not have the quorum.
Yeah.
And the deputy majority leader was very livid. But at the end of the day, you see, it goes to the point that even though they are there in their partisan colors, they should think of the national development agenda. Parliament's foremost responsibility is to pass laws to aid in the development of the country. And so even if the Supreme Court has said it is ABCD,
Some of them are not happy. This loan is not going to develop constituents that passed, that voted for MPP. It's going to cause every single part of the country.
Interesting.
And so I believe that the various chief whips of the parties or the leadership should be able to reach a consensus on some of these things, and then let's move the country forward.
Ni, what do you say about that? And there have been times I have spoken here about the statistics, and our parliament is a place you have a lot of lazy people. They cannot be bothered. They get all the fat salaries, they get all the perks that come with it, but often, they are not interested in the business of the House. So, even getting the ordinary quorum of, is it 92 people, has become difficult before, that a budget has had to be shelved because they can't find just that small number out of, what, 275. So, what does it say about them in the first place that they can't get a quorum?
You know, I remember that back in the law faculty when we went there some 20 years or so ago, at the beginning when Professor Kumado was our professor, I remember that this issue about attendance and numbers was discussed in one of the tutorial sessions. And I remember, if I remember correctly, that Professor Kumado had made a point that he had done some research about attendance and numbers and all of that. And at that time, I think there were 200 of them, right? Mm-hmm. And that the explanation that he had received was not so much that they were lazy, per se, to borrow your word, but that he had discovered that there were so many things that happened in that building outside of the main chamber. That there were so many committee meetings, there were visits to places.
The facts would show that that is a lame excuse, whilst it can be germane in certain circumstances.
Right.
In sometimes, for example, the NPP wants to do some particular business. What is it that is being done in some committee that deprives them from marshalling their numbers into the House? And now you see how they are livid and criticizing Adjoa Safo and saying she is holding them to ransom. But you can't even count half of your members in the House to get a quorum.
Yeah, so that's the point I'm making.
Ordinary business.
So the point is that is the explanation that we have heard. Sometimes, I mean, I don't know how it works, but I think that there should be a solution. The solution is that Parliament is there to do a business, and when it works in plenary, perhaps that is the main business, but that's not to take away the things they do in bits.
Right.
Nothing stops Parliament, and I'm sure we'll have that discussion about it being a master of its own rules and all that. I have a position on that, you know, constitutionally, how it fits into the judgment of the Supreme Court and all, and whether we have really created a new scenario and all. It's a very key point that I would like to deal with at some point. But nothing prevents Parliament from ensuring that whenever it has to do its core business, if you may call it so, where it's sitting in plenary and all of that, that it will not have any side business at the time. Nothing prevents Parliament from doing so. And the courts have said that consistently, from Tufo and Attorney General through 31st to whatever, all those cases to date, including the Abdullahi case. What happens in that they can do it. So they can say that, look, in order to ensure that our business rides and runs and all of that, we will not be doing these committee sittings and whatever at this point, at that point, and all of that, so that we can ensure that people are there. I think that is what will help. You know, to check the problem. And also some discipline.
Right.
Some enforcement of attendance. And it's work.
Speaker after speaker have complained about this attitude of the MPs, but they don't seem to get any results. Unfortunately, they don't also apply the rules that could lead to sanctioning some of them. I don't know what we can do. But Osman, let's hear you briefly on this. And this exposes something that we have been familiar with. They are often without a quorum, but they do the business. They overlook. When we were pursuing the RTI Act bill, I knew what was going on. So a person who doesn't want the RTI bill, they will do all the business without a quorum. Immediately it gets to the RTI bill, then somebody will rise up and say there's no quorum. And by the law, once somebody says there's no quorum, they must stop. Is this the way this judgment should be used, in the way the minority is using it? Oh, Osman just left us. Okay, interesting there. This is Newsfire, brought to you by Bank of Africa, MTN, HSC University, Robert & Sons, Wayleed Properties, CBG, Edlom Housing, Duroplus, and Rehoboth Properties. Now, let's get to how to implement the decision of the House. Bobby, before I get to Bobby. Yes, Adlai, just Adlai. So does it look, are the prospects any bright for a review? Now that we are talking about possibly getting some fundraising to help you. please unmute your mic.
Sorry, thank you so much. The funding would be a welcoming news because I've already put it out there that I'll need all the support that I can. And indeed, it's not, it shouldn't just be limited to funding. It should also include other material support and advices that come from all of you. I have had some of our colleagues from both ends offering pieces of advice, giving me leads as to what do you think I should look at for the possible review. Some even giving authorities to aid in the review application processes.
Mm. And by saying authorities, he's referring to research material. Yes, go ahead.
Indeed. And I'm indeed grateful for all those showing that love and concern for Mother Ghana. I do not think it is a love for Justice Abdullahi.
Right.
I take it as a love for Ghana. And I have also indicated that I've rejected some few monies donated by some other persons, and I had to do so because I take it that those who actually have the resources, who can fund this, because it's an expensive venture, they are available and they should be able to do the funding, and not the ordinary Ghanaian who is already struggling for bread and butter. I've had to return some few thousands and 2,000 here and there, and I am deeply grateful for those who have been doing that. I don't take it lightly. I take it as a very good gesture from Mother Ghana, for my personal opinion.
Give us a sneak peek into the prospects. Let's say about three main grounds, potential grounds.
I'll come there. I thought you would allow me to. I know the time is of the essence here, but I was hoping to exhaust your question first before I come to the grounds. But if you want to push me there, as the Supreme Court itself said, this is a very difficult area because, as they admitted, there are no precedents anywhere, and so they literally have to do a literal interpretation of the Constitution to come up with a decision. In fact, if you check the decision itself on the interpretation of these matters, it was just about five pages. I mean, the rest were to discuss whether they had jurisdictions and other policy reasons and stuff. But the real issue was less than five pages, and that tells you how difficult it was for the Supreme Court to come up with this decision. And unfortunately, it has been met with these criticisms. I'm looking at few areas to be interpreted.
Give us at least about three of them.
Okay, let me give you the few that I can. I'm looking at whether it is indeed looking at Article 295 and 104, whether it can easily be said that the deputy minister does not hold the same function as the deputy speaker. If you properly construe Article 295 clause 2A and Article 104, whether those two offices could not be said to be one and the same in their function. We should remember that even though the Supreme Court touched based on these areas, but they did not do any exhaustive analysis. And I'm hoping that I bring other nuances and other areas of this. Let's remember that the rules of court already provide the statutory grounds based on which a party intending to file a review should come. Now, under some of these grounds, what I'm looking at should come up. And so I'm looking at where 295.2a and 104.2 can be construed to be one and the same, considering that the Constitution itself provides that the holder of an office includes a substantive and the deputies and any person acting in that office. And so I'm hoping that when these two are jointly interpreted, the two can be said to be one and the same, for which reason then the deputy minister, the deputy speaker, cannot be indeed counted and vote in any decision making in Parliament. Second, I'm also looking at the possibility of using the authority of JHU. So here I'm looking at the true and proper interpretations of Article 104.2, 295, and the principles enunciated in the JHU versus Attorney General of 2005-2006, where the Supreme Court had to import words into the Constitution. Now, let's remember that in the decision of the South Line Attorney General, the Supreme Court is literally saying that because Article 104 does not, in fact, no part of the Constitution details out any limitations on the deputy speakers. And so because there's no limitation on all, because there's no positive prohibition on the deputy minister, I mean, speakers, they are entitled to be counted and vote. Now I'm saying that if you read a judgment of Ajaechum, where the speaker, where the Supreme Court itself had to import words into the Constitution, specifically the prima facie phrase, was imported into the Constitution when it does not exist. I'm looking at the possibility where this can be used by the Supreme Court to import into Article 104 or 102 to mean that the deputy speakers do not also have the rights similar to what the speaker is also forbidden from in Article 104 clause 2. So these are some of the things that I'm juggling up with. Of course, we should remember that these are all drafts, that they are not final. And I'm hoping that the more research that I am able to do within this 1 month period, I'll be able to come up with something that will be more convincing and that will be able to tilt the balance in favor of myself and indeed all the Ghanaians out there who believe that the Supreme Court will probably be able to change their mind.
Okay.
If you read the exposition by Professor Sire, he gives some other solid analysis. And indeed, I've read my brother Osman's position as well. But if you read Professor Sari's epistles, you will notice that he takes each of the grounds based on which the Supreme Court literally came to its conclusion that the speakers cannot be counted and cannot, as a result, vote. He takes each of these grounds and analyzes them and gives you the fallacies in some of the grounds, particularly when you look at the position of the Supreme Court took in respect of the non-voting right of the deputy speaker, based on the fact that he wears two hats.
Okay.
And reading this, it's a solid understanding as to why the Supreme Court shouldn't have come to the conclusion that it came, because some each of them.
And you are setting in your mind at this point that a review will carry the day, will overturn this decision.
My objective has always been one, to be able to convince the Supreme Court to change their mind. Mm. I have heard people saying that indeed 7-0 is almost impossible to change. I admit that it is a very difficult task. I am not oblivious of that at all. However, I do not think that the Supreme Court works with numbers. It is not a mathematical court.
Okay.
It's a court.
All right. So hold on for me there, Osman. And I speak to Osman and come to you, Bobby, before I come back to the studio. Bobby, I'd like you to tell us whether you think that the threshold required for a review is not too difficult in these circumstances. The two grounds for which a review will be permitted, because a review is not at large, you know. So, Osman, you have also written, and from the position you share, which aligns with Professor Kukua Sari and others who disagree with this judgment, what do you see to be the potential grounds that can overturn this decision?
Well, first of all, as for the grounds for review, you know, it's a very narrow corridor. And so they will first ask you what's the error of law. So definitely you need to demonstrate some error of law that, you know, that occasion miscarriage of justice. As for miscarriage of justice, you know, we all are the victims. The whole country is the victim if there's an error of law. But looking at it, I have already written that I think the Supreme Court didn't take into consideration some other words in Article 102, which has to do with the exception clauses or with what I call the saving clauses. You know, Article 102 is the only provision that mentions the idea of the presiding officer in parliament not being part of a quorum. That's where it is mentioned. But we are asked to limit it to that provision. And I'm saying that there are some other provisions in Article 104 2, that import that limitation into 104. Because, you see, if you look at that provision, 104.2 especially, which is talking about the members of parliament voting, I think majority of parliament vote, members of parliament voting, determining a matter by vote, you will see that it started with the words except as otherwise provided in this constitution. And you see, and the except as otherwise is an exception for the quorum, is an exception for the number of members, is an exception for who will be a member of the quorum that is being provided for in Article 104. For me, I have made that argument so clearly. I tried my best to make it so clearly that they didn't take into consideration those saving clauses. And you can see that in other provisions where there are saving clauses in the judgment, they took very serious consideration of them and they arrived at a conclusion. For me, I don't think the context of the Constitution, as they said, has warranted a departure from the provision that is linking speaker to a presiding officer. Because, you see, a deputy speaker or anybody presiding is acting in the stead of a speaker. And there's a provision of the Constitution that links, that says that anytime we mention speaker in the Constitution, we are referring to the person also presiding. But you see, the Supreme Court has come to the conclusion that no, that provision doesn't apply because in it, there is the word except or unless the context otherwise requires. And they went through the whole provisions of Article 95, 96, 97, and came to the conclusion, Chapter 10, and came to the conclusion that no, that context does not, required that they don't call or they don't refer to the deputy speaker who is acting as the speaker, which means that every limitation, privilege, or right that applies to the speaker will not apply to the deputy speaker when he's presiding. I think I disagree with that because I think that the context rather reveals otherwise, contrary, because you see, it is the principle of objectivity and impartiality that the context revealed that the framers of the Constitution wants to project. If you look at it well, because you see, when the speaker becomes a speaker, he ceases to be a member of parliament. Now, if you look at, if we leave the speaker alone and go to the deputy speaker, you will find that if a minister or a deputy minister becomes a deputy speaker, under Article 81, he ceases to be a minister, which means that the Constitution doesn't want the deputy speaker, just like the speaker, to be a member of the executive. So you can see, so why would the Constitution prevent a deputy speaker from being a minister or deputy minister? It is because it wants to be, the Constitution wants him to be impartial because he would be presiding. And you see, to say that because there's an express provision relating to the speaker excluding him from being, from voting or from having original or casting vote, but no express limitation on the deputy speaker, I think that also is erroneous.
All right. Now, if you can deal with this last one briefly for us, then we'll continue. You also, like others, impeach the Supreme Court, as it were, invoking its jurisdiction to strike down Order 109 of the Standing Orders of Parliament as being null, void, and of no effect. How so?
Yes, you see, first of all, I expressed concerns about the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court not properly being invoked in this matter. Because, you see, we have looked at several cases and we have realized that even where the original jurisdiction is invoked in respect of interpreting some provision of the Constitution, if the provision of a Constitution comes up for interpretation, which is not stated in the original rate, they decline interpretation of that particular, and I have cited several cases. But in this case, you can see that Justice Abdullahi never brought in any provision of law saying that it is inconsistent with any provision of the Constitution before the Supreme Court. Secondly, Secondly, you could see that the interpretation of the Supreme Court is filling up a gap, because they admit that there has not been any provision that limits the Deputy Speaker from being part of a quorum or from voting. So the same way, there's no provision giving him that right to count himself. There's no express provision anywhere that says that the Speaker, the Deputy Speaker, should be part of a quorum or should have an original vote. And so we take it that this is a matter the Constitution hasn't provided for.
Okay.
And if the Constitution hasn't provided for it, I think the best place is the residual powers of Parliament, which is in 298.
Okay.
And so the Constitution confers on Parliament residual powers to deal with matters that it doesn't provide for. The Constitution, the Supreme Court, has no jurisdiction to fill in those gaps. That's
all right.
My point.
All right. I think maybe eventually I'll ask you guys to maybe in some 30, you know, seconds or 1 minute, tell me your view of whether or not it's not a good guide to look at the 1957 and then look at the Parliament Act, Section 14 also, as a guide as to what was intended, that in fact a Deputy Speaker was intended to be able to exercise his vote even when he was presiding or whoever was presiding. Now, Bobby, does it not look like the grounds as they are an attempt to enter the eye of a needle? Hello, Bobby.
Hello, can
yes.
you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I would have to agree with you. It looks like, to be frank, like a 0.1% chance. You see, the reason mostly being that with a review, unless in exceptional circumstances, it is the same panel, the 7 original panel, is retained, and 2 members are added. And so you are starting from a position where you have 7 against 2. I mean, I know not like mathematically, but at the back of your mind, the 2 are the ones that are coming in with fresh mind. And so the ease with which you can convince them, it's let's say, on an equal 50-50. But with the 7, they already have given you their conclusion, and it was unanimous. And so it's like you're moving them from 0 to 50. It's tougher. And that is a fact we must admit. More so when the Supreme Court had indicated that even if their decision was erroneous, you cannot come and argue the same points of law before them on review. And let me give you this interesting, you know, the NIB case, where the Supreme Court held that the fact that the plaintiff did not endorse the writ with an address rendered the whole writ nullity.
Right.
You know, there was an application for review.
Right.
That time, Justice Amegache was the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And he argued it. Justice Atuguba made a very interesting statement. He said that on second thought, and I'm paraphrasing, he agrees that the decision may have been erroneous. However, because of the limited circumstances that they can exercise their review jurisdiction, he would decline the application for review.
Hmm.
With the hope that if similar facts come before the Supreme Court by way of a fresh writ, the Supreme Court would depart from that previous decision. And so, and Justice Datiba has given in numerous cases this particular instance, or this particular ambit, where they say, okay, our decision may have been erroneous, but the ambit of a review is so tiny that we will not use it as another appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, because there's no appellate jurisdiction. And so even though it's the you will be able to let them see the error in their decision, it will be difficult to argue fresh points of law or error apparent on the face of law. From what Abdullahi said about the basis for his review application, he's not introducing any new law. He's saying that Justice Kulendi and his colleagues misinterpreted and misapplied the law. So you are not saying that there's a new law that was not brought to the attention. All that you are saying is that there may have been misinterpretation of it. And so you are not arguing any fresh error of law, but saying that you disagree with their conclusion. And they may see it as you trying to invoke an appellate jurisdiction, which they do not have.
You are re-arguing your case.
You are redoing your case.
So I, and I know you've not asked, I do not agree with the conclusions of the courts on this. I do not. For various reasons, most of which have been argued by my brother Osman. If I may add, just briefly, that if you look at the part of the decision that was stated, that there is no way the framers would have intended that a member of parliament would be denied a right to vote for his constituency. Under no circumstances should any standing orders be interpreted to have that effect. You ask yourself what happens to the provisions in the standing orders that gives parliament the right to sanction and suspend a member from sitting if he is found guilty of contempt of parliament. So that member who has been suspended, for instance, cannot vote. I think there's five sittings or seven sittings. And so why didn't the Supreme Court go to the extent of striking out those provisions in the standing orders too?
Can that not be said to be an exception?
Yes, but in that same way where the standing orders gave a clear provision that seems to take away a right of the member to vote under certain circumstances.
Because of a conduct that is prohibited.
Yes, so why are we not saying that same powers of parliament to pass these standing orders where they have expressly, remember that standing order leaves no room for ambiguity. There's no ambiguity in that order. That states clearly that if you are presiding, you do not have a right to vote. It is stated very clearly with no ambiguity. So why are we saying in one aspect, no, we will not agree because it takes away the right of the member to represent his people. But that same way, why wouldn't parliament say, listen, the person may have committed a crime. We will not allow him to partake in parliamentary debates. But when it comes to voting, he can come and vote because he's representing his people. It leaves a lot of room for inconsistency.
Interesting. Thank you, Bobby Banson. And now let me come to Nia Declerck. And the Supreme Court, by the law, will not review a decision unless on two grounds, that there is an exceptional circumstance which has resulted in miscarriage of justice. So the circumstance must be exceptional, number one. And two, it must have resulted in miscarriage of justice. You need to show that. Or number two, that after the decision, you have discovered a new and important, it must not only be new, but it must be an important matter or evidence which, after the exercise of due diligence, was not within your knowledge or could not have been produced by you at the time the decision was given. What a tall order.
Yes.
Me?
Absolutely. It's a tall order because that is what it is. The basis of that is what a Latinate expression, interest republicae, puts it finicity on.
You love your Latin.
Yeah. That's in the interest of the republic that litigation must come to an end.
That's right.
At some point. And that we can see the difficulty with the Supreme Court when it exercises its original jurisdiction. That can be some sort of a challenge to that principle. Because then, generally, if the case goes through a number of courts, is on appeal, high courts, blah, blah, name it, and comes, you think that, look, it must come to an end at some point. But with the constitutional interpretation, we've decided that then we can have some sort of a review, not just with constitutional review, but I'm saying that in that arena, that's what you get. And that review, considered by as many as five people at a minimum, in this particular case, seven people who have gone through whatever it is they have considered, we think that you must have a good basis to seek a review of it, which is that you get a second bite of the cherry. So it is a difficult exercise. Nobody can deny that. Exceptional circumstances. You have to even convince the court that these things that I consider exceptional should be exceptional to you. And in addition to that, you sitting there listening to me was involved in a miscarriage of justice. I mean, as one leg, and also a new important matter. And they have emphasized, I'll just look at Republic versus High Court General Jurisdiction case in 2020, where the court, I think it was Chief Justice himself, was very clear, citing previous authorities, that the Supreme Court will not permit a review to be a rehearing of the matter, when they were distinguishing between an appeal and a review.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court has done that consistently. If you're on appeal, it is a rehearing. We can decide to look at the record. In a review, we can look at the record only when those exceptional circumstances arise. Otherwise, you must show us these two things. And I'm sure that Alhaji knows that. Osman knows that. Everybody else there knows it. It's part of our training. We know it. And it is the rules by which we play. At this stage, if Alhaji can show us those exceptional circumstances and miscarriage of justice, discovery of new material and all of that, then I think that the Supreme Court should hear him. I am not worried about whether he will end up with a 7-2 or a 9-2 or 7-2, right? Because you had two more, so you get a 9.
Yeah.
And 7-2 or that you get an 8-1 or you get one. That is not my worry. And so I will not say don't go simply because 7 have already done it. His challenge at this time is to convince himself within the period that he has, is it a month or so?
Yeah, 30 days.
30 days to convince the court that he can find these. If he cannot, so be it. This is the state of the law. And this
the door is shut.
Yeah, the door will be shut. But look, I think that we should refer, if we have better minds, to a certain provision. You know, a lot of the time I hear this argument, this point being made that, look, the Supreme Court did not have some old decision to go by, or that there was no guide on them. But that is why it is the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
That is the reason. It is the Supreme Court, actually.
But you know, as a lawyer, it's difficult when you're arguing and you can't have precedent to fall on.
Absolutely.
I've done one such case recently and it's difficult.
Absolutely.
You must engineer the new argument.
I love that, actually. Mm. I prefer that.
Mm.
A lot of the time, the so-called precedents do not deal with the issue the way you are bringing it before the court.
Right, times have changed.
You've had so many discussions. People have talked about standing. People have talked about the participation of parliament in this matter. People have talked about the political question doctrine as it applies. People have spoken about the standing orders.
People have questioned why the attorney general,
yes,
who represents and is a political appointee,
is now appearing on behalf of parliament, which is a different arm of government.
Sort of appearing on behalf of the people, yes, who are coming to the court against.
Because he's an advisor to the executive. Not to parliament, then that becomes a matter. And then people questioning and all that. Look, the political question doctrine in particular, which is a very key discussion in this, has featured in the Supreme Court judgments of this country as far as judicial review is concerned on so many bases. Yes, in Tufon Attorney General Sowa read the judgment. He never used the expression political question. So I'll leave that, even though he did a lot of analysis that formed the basis.
In simple terms, what is political questioning doctrine?
Okay. So as I was saying, 20 years ago, when we were all reading these matters, we saw these cases and these references and all of that. Even Baker and Carr is on the at the law faculty Legon. Baker and Carr is part of the cases on the course outline. We went through it and touched on it. But I must tell you that it is in studying for and taking the New York bar exam that I really came to appreciate some of these things. And I, Kwesi Prempeh in particular, HKP, I've known him for over 20 years, an extremely bright fellow. I'll set him apart, tell you the truth.
He says this judgment,
yes,
is fidelity to the text and yes, structure of the Constitution.
I agree with him.
Even though he has some issues and calls it messy, including the Attorney General representing, as it were, the other side.
I'd like to say quickly that the Attorney General representing the other side is not a problem in the eyes of the current law. What he is saying sounds more like a recommendation to me. The point is that, can you fault the fact that this is what happened? Is he saying that he faults?
But the Supreme Court has had cause to say that it's not in every situation that the Attorney General can competently,
yes,
represent,
yes,
an institution,
yes,
of state.
I agree.
Yes.
So because the Attorney General,
the Attorney General's, you know, as it were, position,
yes,
may or will conflict with that entity.
Something. Mm. Don't misunderstand me.
Right.
I agree with Kwesi Prempeh's point. I am saying that he cannot tell me that for that reason this judgment is defective.
Okay.
That's the point I'm making.
He doesn't say that.
Okay. I am saying that the structurally, I agree with him 1,000% that we have an attorney general who is a member of the executive, clearly a legal advisor to the president, etc., representing the matter featuring parliament. It's a place we should look at. It makes a lot of sense to me. But I'm saying that it is on that basis, we cannot say that because of that, this judgment has been rendered nugatory. I hope you get the point I'm trying to establish, that it does not become migratory only for that purpose. That is, it makes a lot of sense to say that in matters like this, perhaps we should look at somebody else doing the representation, all of that. Political question doctrine.
Mm.
The political question doctrine, as I have understood it, you have come to understand it, is quite simple. It says that there are times when, and don't forget, it's an American constitutional development.
All right.
That's what we need to understand. Mm. It is a concept in American constitutional law.
So he says there are times when what?
They are saying that generally, there are situations where, for example, final judicial authority or final authority is given to a certain body, a certain other institution other than the judiciary, to make a determination on an issue. When that arises, because that person has been given that power, or that organ of government has been given that power, you must leave that organ to make the final determination on that particular matter.
Mm.
That is what it is. In fact, they have a whole line of cases, but we keep referring to Baker and Carr because Baker and Carr gave us about six scenarios. And we have our Supreme Court in J.H. Mensah versus Attorney General, our Supreme Court in the case of the NPP versus Attorney General 31st December, in particular, all of that, dealt with those matters at length. They all talked about that American concept which is creeping into Ghanaian law.
Mm.
The position has been taken, and I don't know if it will waste your time. If it will not waste your time, if you will permit me, I would like to just read a small portion on Justice Akwa. Akwa's comment on the political, doctrine question.
So in a very common way,
in a very common way,
many have said that
yes.
The political question doctrine
yes.
simply means yes. or is a doctrine that refers to the idea that an issue is so politically charged
no.
that the courts, which are typically viewed as apolitical branch of government, the apolitical branch of government, should not hear the issue when it comes before them.
So here it is.
Mm.
I'll give you the six bases.
Mm.
Okay. One, textually demonstrable constitutional commitment of the issue to a coordinate political department.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. Two,
don't interfere in someone because you're all arms of government.
Yes, because the constitution.
Mm.
You're not saying that because you're all arms of government. You're saying that the constitution has given that power to another organ of government.
Okay.
The political question has arisen so many times. For example, in the US, the president has the authority with respect to some foreign policy matters and all of that. When he takes a decision on that score, should the court interfere or not? We've had some exceptions to which with respect to some citizenship of an American born in Israel and whether for that reason, all those things. I don't want to get too much into that, but just so people understand. The first one is that the Constitution itself, which is supreme, says that when it comes to this matter, this organ, the executive, or the legislature, is the final authority.
Mm.
So that part of power has already been given.
Okay.
Or two, there's a lack of judicially discoverable and manageable standards for resolving it. And recently they've been talking about gerrymandering
mm-hmm.
and things like that.
Yeah.
That when they are coming for order, can we have a judicially manageable basis to make a determination with respect to borders and drawing them and all of that? And if they don't think so, then they will leave that to the Congress or
to the question.
But in Ghana,
to the question, do you see any implications
yes.
for the future of the parliament and our governance
yes.
that this decision brings up?
We see a lot in this. And just to close that, so in Ghana, largely, constitutional assignment. The Supreme Court has said, and perhaps you don't have time, so I'll leave it, that the political question doctrine is not something that we take hook, line, and sinker.
Right.
All right?
Right.
And all the other. Mm. Something. Again, just give me 2 minutes.
Go ahead.
There's this important thing that we need to understand. This point is that, look, we are running a state. We have our rules. We have a history, whether we like it or not. We came from somewhere. We all know that we were colonized by the British, correct? We know that the British have their rules. I've heard a lot of debates, even from some members of parliament, saying, for example, that the British parliament does this, that. Jack, let's understand where we stand. Today, even today, you know that currently the British have a Supreme Court. They didn't used to have one. It was the House of Lords.
Right.
Since the 1st of October 2009, they have instituted a Supreme Court. That has not changed the understanding of judicial review when the court is pronouncing something unconstitutional. They say clearly that the Supreme Court of the UK cannot declare primary legislation as unconstitutional. Why? It is based on a certain belief in what? Parliamentary sovereignty. Cross over to the United States of America, who were also colonized by the British. They say that the court, as the final arbiter, can declare these matters unconstitutional. However, in doing so, they make a certain limitation based on their understanding of separation of powers by saying that they have a political question doctrine in itself struggling to come to terms. That says that when that final authority or some other basis exists, that the court will not do that thing. And yet they still allow the court to make that pronouncement that is for that person. I can still sue you. Okay. That's if I can't go to court.
Right.
The court can make the pronouncement that, oh, in this instance, it belongs there. Bro, we had that 1957 constitution battles. You remember Laudan number 2 against Attorney General and all that. That question came up. The court itself in Ghana said that there was some parliamentary sovereignty that they could not strike as an act. In worry against Oforiatta at that time, an act was struck down as invalid. But 1960 was tighter. And that is where we had our seminal Riakoto case. And look, if we don't look at the background to these matters, we get lost in the...
So what are the implications we can see?
All right, I guess you want me to end the historical analysis.
Yeah.
So I'll come to the implications that we can see. The implication we can see is that Ghana has charted its own course. We have been charting this course for a very long time. We have taken the position that because once upon a time, we could even have a PDA passed by Parliament, where in somebody's satisfaction, they can arrest you, as the Supreme Court said in that time, prior to you committing the act, based on some problems that you could cause us, he went to court.
Put you in jail without
trial. The Attorney General at that time, Geoffrey Byng, who is from the UK, argued parliamentary sovereignty. J.B. Dankwa...
The judgment refers to this.
J.B. Dankwa, yes. Yeah. J.B. Dankwa argued the other side. J.B. Dankwa lost. But the J.B. Dankwa position became the position of Ghana starting from 1969, where we wanted to be clear that the final arbiter is the Supreme Court, and that the court can deal with these matters. Of course, the Constitution is supreme. And we have held on to that position to date. So we don't do too much history.
Mm.
What I see is that we are clear in our minds at this time through this judgment that the final arbiter, whichever way you look at it, is the court.
Okay.
That the court can make us whatever Parliament does, it can do. Okay. There's this argument about some closed book and all of that.
Yeah.
They say that what Sowah said was that as long as what Parliament has done is in conformity with Article 91 at that time, or that is in conformity with the Constitution today, it's a closed book.
Okay.
But if it doesn't follow, that will not happen.
That's
so
correct.
Today, we have taken a position in Ghana, and it's clear that when there's a dispute, where there's a parliamentary action, where there's an act, where there are standing orders, whatever, and it flies in the face of the Constitution of the Republic of Ghana, the courts are in the position. There's no political question limitation to declare that this will happen.
Mm.
But what we have seen is that on the political front, what is happening in Parliament is what will happen.
Mm.
What is the way out? We have to learn to live with each other. We have to now learn consensus building, something we have never done. It's a very divided political front in Parliament. It has always been. For the first time, the numbers are forcing us to find a way to work together, to find middle ground, to make peace with each other, and to all of that. The anger will die down, I think. What is happening will die down. Somebody's taking a sucker in the fact that they've won a decision. And yet now the other side seems to be the one who is using it for their own benefit and all of that. I think calm heads should prevail. The leadership there should be made to come together. We must sit. And we are now forced, whether we like it or not, to talk to each other. It's like two bad friends who are two talented members of a football team who need to rely on each other.
Okay.
And that is the scenario we have.
Yeah, so I'm asking you guys briefly to tell us what you think are the implications for the Parliament in the implementation of the decision. One of the deputy speakers, first deputy speaker, Joe Oseiwusu, has said that he will not even attempt to step down from his seat to cast his vote, because that is what brought the fight the last time. He will remain in his seat and simply be counted for the quorum and proceed to vote when it's time for voting. How is that going to be easy to implement? But first, what do you say whether or not Section 14 of the Parliament Act, and as I said earlier, which repeats, if you like, the 1957 provision, What does that say to you? Because in that provision, it says a deputy speaker or any other who is presiding has an original vote. He does not only have a casting vote. Bobby, let me have Abdullahi first. Very briefly, in 1 minute.
Samson, what we have to remember is that we have carved up this sort of system for ourselves where we seek to project some amount of impartiality going forward. This is what we have sought to do with our lives in Parliament. Mm. If you check the standing orders of Parliament, it took away the entire right of the Deputy Speaker from having an original vote.
Yeah, so the standing orders cannot conflict the Parliamentary Act. The Parliament Act.
Subsidiary. I agree.
Right.
So clearly, from that two angle, from those two angles. Now, something, let's remember that the standing orders was not even though it being a subsidiary legislation, was not approved by Parliament through the usual provisions under Article 11.
Okay.
This standing orders literally came to live with us without having to go through all the right processes. So it's quite difficult to even call it a law, even though it is being practiced as a law.
They have tabled the new one that they are seeking to approve to become their standing orders.
And that should be that can probably be called a law if you want to.
I want your direct statement on Section 14 of the Parliament Act, which says a deputy speaker or anyone presiding has the right to vote, original votes.
Now that is directly in conformity with what the Supreme Court has said. However, if it is in conflict with what the standing orders have put out, because the standing orders have taken that right away.
You just said by the hierarchy of laws in Article 11, the standing orders cannot deviate from
the standing order and still remain good law. The standing order has more challenges, as I've said earlier.
Right.
It didn't go through the usual processes of passing it. And so it has its own challenges with that.
So that's a messy confusion.
So my point is that in addition to the confusion it's creating, this provision is clearly indirect, even though it was not before the Supreme Court, and so they clearly did not have their minds to read. It is in conformity with the decision in Justice Abel and Attorney General. However, my point, having said that, what I'm pointing out is this. The Constitution itself, it being silent on all these matters, at the time I was giving you the grounds that I'll be advancing for a review, having indicated the already statutory grounds, you'll notice that matters the Constitution hasn't said anything. The Constitution hasn't said anything at all about whether or not the deputy speakers can vote or not vote. So but for this decision, what you'll be confronted with is whether the Supreme Court would have the right to pronounce, and would be confronted with a pronunciation on this issue of the constitutionality or otherwise of Section 14 of the Constitution, because the Constitution doesn't say anything about it. And my position has been that where the Constitution does not expressly sanction a particular conduct or does not prescribe it, taking into consideration all other provisions in the Constitution, one should be able to determine the line that the Constitution would want all of us to move.
Okay.
And in doing so, we may have to ask ourselves that salient question. What were the previous constitutions saying? What did they say regarding that area?
All right, thank you. Let me go to Bobby. And Bobby, within 1 minute, I'm holding you to it. Within 1 minute, what do you say about whether or not there is guidance from the 1957 Constitution, Article 40 of that, and also Section 14 of the Parliament Act, which, as far as I know, remains good law in Ghana. And it says that the Speaker shall have neither an original nor a casting vote. This is the same thing that was said in that Constitution. But any other person presiding, including a deputy speaker, shall have an original vote, but no casting vote. If this is still law, how can you disagree with the Supreme Court?
I think that whether it is still law is even arguable. The reason for me saying that is that I believe that Act of Parliament was passed in the 1965.
That's right.
Which was based on the constitution that you read, the 1957 constitution. Now we have the current standing orders, which were based on the 1992 constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Now you ask yourself whether or not the provision in the 1957 constitution have been carried forward in its terms as it was in the 1957 constitution into the 1992 constitution. I do not think it is the same word for word.
Should we not rather be asking ourselves whether or not that law that we have just referred to, that act, remains law after Justice VCRAC Crabb did his work on it?
Yes, I will not doubt that it doesn't remain law. But whether or not, if there are provisions in there that conflict with the standing orders, what will be the interpretation and application? And Justice, and you have rightly said, as it stands now, we do not know the character of the standing orders, whether they should be treated as subsidiary legislation, whether they should be treated as Act of Parliament properly so-called. If they are treated as Act of Parliament, does it mean that if they contain it being a latter in time law, if it contain provisions that conflict with the 1965 one, whether by the rules of interpretation, it will be deemed that the framers of this latter law intended to repeal any other provision in any other law that conflicts it. So I don't think that it's set in stone that automatically it's binding on it. So that is my position. Depending on how you argue it, it could be good law or it could be repealed by the standing orders, depending on the nature of the character that you give to the standing orders.
Interesting. Interesting. On that matter, I go to Isana Nankuma's Facebook wall, and he made this post. He said, the Statute Law Review Commissioner, VCRAC Crabb, was asked to review existing laws and bring them into accord with the Constitution. Parliament passed his revisions, and the Supreme Court upheld his revisions to be law. But when it came to Section 14 of Act 300, that's the law we are referring to, the commission did no review. The commissioner did no review. He merely expressed an opinion in footnote 25. That Section 14 has been superseded by Article 104. But what did that mean? Implied repeal? But is Article 104 really at variance with Section 14(2) of Act 300? Although the Supreme Court did not appear to have considered this section, their interpretation of Article 104 actually aligns the article with the pre-existing Section 14 of Act 300. That would mean that Section 14 remains good law and was never repealed, at least not by the Constitution. Osman, what do you say?
First of all, before I get to this question, let me say that the political question we are discussing, I don't think is much of an issue. I don't think anybody is saying that the Supreme Court doesn't have the authority to strike down a law that is inconsistent with the Constitution. What is actually in dispute?
Many people have said that. Many people have said that. You have not listened to some of the NDC guys?
Very well.
Yes.
Very well.
Initially, even a lawyer among the minority group, Haruna Idrisu himself, has said he was shocked that we were trying to interfere or invade the space of Parliament. And what did you hear the Speaker also say? Right,
yes,
so go ahead.
What I'm trying to say is that I don't think they are not saying Parliament is above the Constitution. They are just saying that law struck down is not inconsistent with any provision of the Constitution. That's how I understand it.
It is the Supreme Court that has the power to say it is consistent or not. It has said it is inconsistent. And to that effect, it uses the power given it by the Constitution to remove it as law.
Yes, so let's leave it at that. But I'm trying to say that the political question is actually not...
right.
But if we can, let me read 298 for you.
Yes, and forgive me, but you have a minute.
Okay. So then let me use my minutes. Now, let me address the question first. Section 14 of the Parliament Act of 1965. We all know that Article 11(6) is requiring that we construe existing law. An existing law is the Act. The Act is an existing law. We should construe it with all the qualifications and necessary adaptations to bring it to conformity with the 1992 Constitution. So it means that if we are to apply that provision, we should first get the Supreme Court to construe it to bring it in conformity with the 1992 Constitution. But that as it may, if we are going to rely on that Act, then the validity that they declare, the validity that they declare for the decision of Parliament approving the budget will fall. You know why? Because if you go back to Section 13 of that Act, you will find that the presiding officer, any person presiding in Parliament, is excluded from forum. So it's not only about Section 14. Let's go to Section 13 of that Act, which talks about forum. And because, you see, this whole decision revolves around quorum and not voting, actually. So he counted himself that if there's no quorum, then they can't be voting. Can they? So, but Section 13 of that Act says this: the deputy speaker or any person presiding should not be part of the quorum.
Okay. Okay. So now, very finally, in 20 seconds, if there is an attempt to stop the implementation of this decision in Parliament, what will happen?
Well, it can only be seen as a consequence of a judgment that probably was not properly, looked into. You see, we can't see this. The question we should ask ourselves is, whatever they are doing to forestall proceedings or progress in Parliament, is it in conformity with the decision or not? If it is in conformity with the decision, then it is a consequence of a bad decision.
Okay, thank you.
We have to deal with.
Bobby, same to you. Because we have heard some of the members of Parliament say, on the opposition side, say that they are masters of their own procedure. And so, as far as they are concerned, they haven't seen any ruling, so to speak, or decision. If somebody attempts to stop a deputy speaker from doing what the court says he is allowed to do, what will happen?
Listen, I doubt any of the minority members will be bold enough to physically stop. I mean, that would be the height of disrespect to the rule of law. They were not happy that the majority decided on their own to overturn the decision of Speaker Babin. They should not take the law into their own hands. The Constitution said if they want, they can amend the standing orders. I think that what they can do is to form a consensus, like Robert said, sit down, look at how they can move the agenda of developing the country through Parliament as an arm of government through, and stop these kind of threats. It cannot happen. We are not if we are in a democratic regime, we have a constitution that gives the power to interpret the constitution to the Supreme Court. If they are not happy, they can go back to the drawing table and come. If anybody attempts to do that, I believe that the conduct of the person, the constitution says that any person who disobeys the orders of the Supreme Court, I think it's high crime or high treason.
High crime.
Yes. So.
And it's liable. It's liable to imprisonment for 10 years.
Yes. And I think that anybody who does that, the Attorney General should take that step and prosecute the person. We may not disagree completely with the ruling of the Supreme Court, but it doesn't mean we should take the law into our own.
So if you did die, it would be high crime and you'd be liable to imprisonment not exceeding 10 years without the option of a fine, and you will then not be eligible for election or for appointment to any public office for 10 years, beginning with the date of the expiration of the term of imprisonment. Abdullahi, what do you say about that? Please unmute.
I'm with Bobby on this, and I think that as I have been indicating, all of us must find a way to forge ahead in unison, because really, whatever the case may be, this is a verdict of the Supreme Court. Until a review changes anything, this is what we have to live with, and we have to find a way to collectively move together as a nation.
All right.
Only we can make progress.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Ni Adeklek will be with us for the second part of this discussion, looking at matters of the economy. And if you know Ni too well, very well, when we say he's an author, he has authored even in the area of corporate governance. So let's see what ideas he will have for us to try to see if it will be listened to lessen our burden in these difficult times. My guests have been Robert Ni Adeklek, who is lawyer and an author. Bobby Banson is lawyer and also teaches the law at the Ghana School of Law. Justice Abdullahi is lawyer and lecturer, UPSA Law School. And Osman Al-Hassan is a lawyer, has authored an article. He does that frequently to criticize judgments when he finds that they do not align with what he perceives to be the right position. This show is brought to you by Bank of Africa, as strong as a group and close as a partner. MTN everywhere you go. Ashasi University, educating ethical and entrepreneurial leaders for Africa. Robert & Sons Optical Services, your comprehensive eye care service provider for 31 years. Waylead Properties, home is where one starts. CBG, we stand with you. Edlom Housing, where spacious homes cost less. Duroplus, where Duroplus goes, water flows. And Rehoboth Properties, quality housing for all. We'll be right back.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.